tuned. So last week when we talked about the Department of Homeland Security, I made a promise to you guys. And that promise was that I would find the clip of James Comey. And he was the Deputy Attorney General under John Ashcroft. And he gave some testimony in 2007 about something that happened during the Bush administration, which is when Bush's Chief of Staff, Andy Card, and Alberto Gonzalez went to the hospital to try and pressure a very sick John Ashcroft into signing off on the warrantless wiretap program, even though he had said that it was illegal and he wasn't going to sign it. So I'm going to play that testimony for you. But here's the thing. While I was on vacation, I did a little bit of reading, and it just so happened that Tom Sherrick of The Nation filled in a lot of blanks in an article that he just released. Now, the article was about Obama's war on whistleblowers, which is legit. I mean, they are prosecuting whistleblowers, including Bradley Manning and these NSA whistleblowers that I'm going to kind of tell you about today. And it's a fascinating article, and you should read it. But in the article, I learned a lot about the NSA and a lot about this warrantless wiretapping program that I didn't know before. So I'm just going to tell you the whole story, and James Comey's testimony is going to come in here when I see fit. So you're going to hear it, but you're going to hear a lot more. And this story is amazing. So I'm really excited about this part of the podcast. So let's get started. Now, flashback to the 1980s. In the 1980s, the NSA did everything in-house. If you think about the 1980s, there was no internet. So all of the work that they did was analyzing radio and microwaves that flew through the air. What changed is the internet age, because no longer would it be sufficient to just do the intercepts of the waves going through the air. You also had to look at the cell phone and email traffic that was going over fiber optic wires, and that required new technologies. So in 1999, the NSA director Michael Hayden decided the government would buy, aka privatize, the technology instead of using what was created by government employees at the NSA. Now in the year 2000, Michael Hayden hired a man named Bill Black. And Bill Black worked for a defense contractor. He was basically a defense contractor mole in the NSA because his job became to privatize the NSA and funnel business to companies like SAIC, which stands for Science Application International Corporation, which up until the time he was hired by Michael Hayden to work at the NSA, SAIC is the company he worked for. So in April 2001, SAIC, Bill Black's company, Booz Allen Hamilton, Lockheed Martin, and a company that soon became Northrop Grumman were given a contract to design and plan the privatized system. And the new privatized system was nicknamed Trailblazer. Now, at the same time that the people in charge of the NSA were busy privatizing this new system that they wanted to develop to analyze internet traffic, there was already a system that was developed inside the NSA by the government NSA employees. And this program was called Thin Thread. Now, Thin Thread proved itself right away to be very effective. What it did is it organized incoming internet traffic by topic. It also hid the identity of U.S. citizens until a warrant was produced. And it translated the data that it brought in from the internet into graphs showing relationships and patterns that could be analyzed to prevent things like 9/11. Now, in the months leading up to 9/11, Thin Thread was already operational in two locations, and they found that when they tested it in these locations that it was effective, and George Tenet was pushing really hard to have this program expanded. In fact, this is the system that he was talking about when he said, quote, the system was blinking red, unquote, before it was shut down in August 2001 by Michael Hayden, who was dedicated to privatizing this function of the NSA. In fact, Michael Hayden shut down Thin Thread without ever even seeing it, even though he'd been told how effective it was. Now, the date that Michael Hayden shut down Thin Thread was August of 2001. It was 3 weeks before 9/11. And as we all know now, because they weren't able to intercept the data and make the connection between Al-Qaeda and all of the hijackers, four planes were hijacked and we lost 3,000 people. In the weeks following 9/11, the manager of Thin Thread, who turned into one of the whistleblowers in Tom Sherrick's article, the manager of Thin Thread rebooted the program and ran some tests to find out if it had been running, would they have been able to stop 9/11? It turns out the answer was yes. They found intelligence, which is still classified, that would have shown links between key individuals and organizations had it been discovered in the 3 weeks before 9/11. And after that embarrassing revelation was discovered, Thin Thread was shut down for good. Now, this is one of those things about the Bush years that kind of goes against logic until you understand what their goals were. Had the goal of Michael Hayden been to find the most efficient, cheapest, best way to analyze intelligence that was sent over the internet, he would have gone with Thin Thread. And that seems pretty obvious here. It was only $3 million. It was 12 people. It worked. But they shut it down. But when you look at the goals of both Michael Hayden and the Bush administration in general, the goal was not to produce the best intelligence. The goal was to privatize the NSA's functions. And so Thin Thread was shut down and Trailblazer went forward, full steam ahead. The year after 9/11 in 2002, SAIC, which was Bill Black's former employer, they were given a contract to create the Trailblazer system for $280 million. A whistleblower in Sherrick's article provided proof that the four companies contracted in early 2001 to create the project planned to give SAIC the contract all along, with the understanding that the other three companies would be giving subcontracting contracts for the Trailblazer system. Now, Trailblazer, aside from the fact that it would be far more expensive and be privatized, was different from Thin Thread in some fundamental ways. One of the ways that it would be different is that unlike Thin Thread, there would be no protections of the privacy of U.S. citizens. There would be no FISA protections at all. Another way it would be different is that unlike Thin Thread, which intercepted the information at the point that it came in and it made graphs showing patterns and stuff, instead of doing it that way, Trailblazer would just download all internet information, your calls, your emails, your texts, everything, store that information, and then the government would be able to analyze it later using keywords. So it keeps all the information as opposed to just letting it pass through and just kind of monitoring what's going through the gates. And it's this Trailblazer system is the reason that the Utah Data Center, which is storing all of your calls, your emails, your texts, it's Trailblazer that is the reason that the Utah Data Center is now being built. Now, sometime in between 9/11 and 2005, we don't know the exact date, there was another program that came to be that is directly connected to the Trailblazer system, and that is a program with the code name Stellar Wind. And Stellar Wind was a massive data mining operation, which began and it involved copying cell phone and email traffic by installing splitter cabinets in certain giant telecom companies. And the one I know for sure is AT&T, although it's been reported that Verizon was also involved. Now, the way that we know about these splitter cabinets is that there was a whistleblower from AT&T, the man who installed a splitter cabinet in San Francisco. His name was Mark Klein. And here's a clip from what used to be Countdown with Keith Olbermann from 2005, I believe, which had an interview with Mark Klein after he gave testimony about the splitter cabinets to Congress.
Third story tonight, an AT&T whistleblower today told members of Congress much more than that is at stake with the secret crimes that took place at room 641A of AT&T's Folsom Street facility in San Francisco and potentially at others across the country. Specifically, retired 22-year AT&T technician Mark Klein says that despite Mr. Bush's claims, the U.S. government used AT&T's cooperation to spy not only on overseas communications, but to vacuum up virtually all of America's use of the internet for years. Email, Googling, web surfing, you name it. Thanks to AT&T's secure rooms like 641A in San Francisco. Cisco, accessible only to those cleared by the NSA. Klein obtaining AT&T schematics showing how the company used splitters to send secure room 641A a duplicate of every fiber optic signal routed through its facilities. And involved not just AT&T customers, but virtually every internet and telecommunications company, and virtually all email and web traffic in the country. Without a warrant, without any mechanism for separating domestic from overseas, without separating suspect from citizen. We welcome now former AT&T technician Mark Klein, whose documentation and claims are now part of a class action lawsuit against AT&T, one of 38 telecom spy lawsuits. AT&T so far declining to comment on the specifics of these allegations. Mr. Klein, great thanks for speaking out tonight.
Thanks for inviting me.
First, can you explain to those of us who can use the internet but would not be able to tell the difference between its physical form and, you know, a box full of guitar strings. Exactly what happened in that secure room or secret room, 641A?
I don't know what goes on in the secret room because I didn't have security clearance. Mm-hmm. But I know what went on outside because my job, I worked in the internet room. My job was to connect circuits into the splitter device, which was hardwired to the secret room. And effectively, the splitter copied the entire data stream of those internet cables into the secret room. And we're talking about phone conversations, email, web browsing, everything that goes across the internet. And that device, the splitters, is a dumb device. It doesn't do any selection at all.
Mm. And the follow-up to that, as you mentioned, you didn't have the security, the NSA clearance. So give us an idea how you know all this, in addition, obviously, to your expertise as a technician.
Well, as a technician, I had the engineering wiring documents, which told me how the splitter was wired to the secret room. And so I had to know that in order to do my job. And so I know that the whatever went across those cables was copied in the entire data stream was copied into the secret room. The splitter device has no selective capability, it just copies everything. And we're talking about domestic traffic as well as international traffic. And that's what got me upset to begin with.
And this brings me to the testimony that I promised to play you guys last week. Jim Comey, who was the acting attorney general, and his boss, John Ashcroft, had refused to sign off on the illegal collection of all our data that was authorized by the Trailblazer/Stellar Wind programs. And so this is James Comey telling you what went down that night in a stunning illustration of the desperation of the Bush administration officials to keep this privatized NSA operation alive.
To understand what happened that night, I kind of got to back up about a week.
Please.
In the early part of 2004, the Department of Justice was engaged, the Office of Legal Counsel under my supervision, in a reevaluation both factually and legally of a particular classified program. And it was a program that was renewed on a regular basis and required signature by the Attorney General certifying to its legality. And I remember the precise date, the program had to be renewed by March the 11th, which was a Thursday of 2004. And we were engaged in a very intensive reevaluation of the matter. And a week before that March 11th deadline, I had a private meeting with the Attorney General for an hour, just the two of us. And I laid out for him what we had learned and what our analysis was of this particular matter. And at the end of that hour-long private session, he and I agreed on a course of action. And within hours, he was stricken and taken very, very ill.
You thought something was wrong with how it was being operated or administered or overseen?
We had concerns as to our ability to certify its legality, and which was our obligation for the program to be renewed. The Attorney General was taken that very afternoon to George Washington Hospital, where he went into intensive care and remained there for over a week. And I became the acting Attorney General. And over the next week, particularly the following week on Tuesday, we communicated to the relevant parties at the White House and elsewhere our decision that as acting Attorney General, I would not certify the program as to its legality, and explained our reasoning in detail, which I will not go into here, nor am I confirming it's any particular program. That was Tuesday that we communicated that. The next day was Wednesday, March the 10th, the night of the hospital incident, and I was headed home at about 8 o'clock that evening. My security detail was driving me, and I remember exactly where I was, on Constitution Avenue, and got a call from Attorney General Ashcroft's chief of staff telling me that he had gotten
What's
a call.
What's his name?
David Ayers. That he had gotten a call from Mrs. Ashcroft from the hospital. She had banned all visitors and all phone calls, so I hadn't seen him or talked to him because he was very ill. And Mrs. Ashcroft reported that a call had come through and that as a result of that call, Mr. Card and Mr. Gonzalez were on their way to the hospital to see Mr. Ashcroft.
Do you have any idea who that call was from?
I have some recollection that the call was from the president himself, but I don't know that for sure. It came from the White House. And it came through, and the call was taken in the hospital. So I hung up the phone, immediately called my chief of staff, told him to get as many of my people as possible to the hospital immediately. I hung up, called Director Mueller, and with whom I'd been discussing this particular matter, and who'd been a great help to me over that week, and told him what was happening. He said, I'll meet you at the hospital right now. Told my security detail that I need to get to George Washington Hospital immediately. They turned on the emergency equipment and drove very quickly to the hospital. I got out of the car and literally ran up the stairs with my security detail.
What was your concern? You were in obviously a huge hurry.
I was concerned that, given how ill I knew the Attorney General was, that there might be an effort to ask him to overrule me when he was in no condition to do that.
Right. Okay.
I was worried about him, frankly. And so I raced to the hospital room, entered, and Mrs. Ashcroft was standing by the hospital bed. Mr. Ashcroft was lying down in the bed. The room was darkened. And I immediately began speaking to him, trying to orient him as to time and place and try to see if he could focus on what was happening. And it wasn't clear to me that he could. He seemed pretty bad off.
And at that point, it was you, Mrs. Ashcroft, and the Attorney General and maybe medical personnel in the room, no other Justice Department or government officials.
Just the three of us at that point. I tried to see if I could help him get oriented. As I said, it wasn't clear that I had succeeded. I went out in the hallway, spoke to Director Mueller by phone. He was on his way. I handed the phone to the head of the security detail, and Director Mueller instructed the FBI agents present not to allow me to be removed from the room under any circumstances. And I went back in the room. I was shortly joined by the head of the Office of Legal Counsel, Assistant Attorney General Jack Goldsmith, and a senior staffer of mine who had worked on this matter, an Associate Deputy Attorney General. So the three of us, Justice Department people, went in the room. I sat down.
Can you just give us the names of the two other people?
It's Jack Goldsmith, who was the Assistant Attorney General, and Patrick Philbin, who was Associate Deputy Attorney General. I sat down in an armchair by the head of the Attorney General's bed. The two other Justice Department people stood behind me. And Mrs. Ashcroft stood by the bed holding her husband's arm, and we waited. And it was only a matter of minutes that the door opened and in walked Mr. Gonzalez carrying an envelope and Mr. Card. They came over and stood by the bed, greeted the Attorney General very briefly, and then Mr. Gonzalez began to discuss why they were there, to seek his approval for a matter, and explain what the matter was, which I will not do. And Attorney General Ashcroft then stunned me. He lifted his head off the pillow and in very strong terms expressed his view of the matter, rich in both substance and fact, which stunned me, drawn from the hour-long meeting we'd had a week earlier, and in very strong terms expressed himself, and then laid his head back down on the pillow, seemed spent, and said to them, but that doesn't matter because I'm not the Attorney General.
But he expressed his reluctance or he would not sign the statement that they give the authorization that they had asked. Is that right?
Yes. And as he laid back down, he said, but that doesn't matter because I'm not the Attorney General. There is the Attorney General. And he pointed to me when I was just to his left. The two men did not acknowledge me. They turned and walked from the room. And within just a few moments after that, Director Mueller arrived. I told him quickly what had happened. He had a brief, memorable, brief exchange with the Attorney General, and then we went outside in the hallway.
Okay. Now, just a few more points on that meeting. First, am I correct that it was Mr. Gonzalez who did just about all of the talking? Mr. Card said very little.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Then less than a year later, in February 2005, Alberto Gonzalez became the Attorney General of the United States, and you better believe they got their authorization. So Stellar Wind was the data mining operation that was providing the data that was going to be analyzed by the Trailblazer system. There was just one big problem with the Trailblazer system. It never existed. We know for sure that the contractors were given $1.2 billion. It's most likely much more, but we know for sure $1.2 billion was spent on Trailblazer, but they never actually provided a system. And very quietly in 2006, the entire project was scrapped. So where does that leave us today? Well, we haven't gone back to thin thread because we are building the Utah Data Center, which stores all of our data. And if we were using the thin thread system, that wouldn't be necessary. Quite frankly, we have no idea what the NSA is using right now to spy on us. But we know that it has to be some kind of hybrid system between Trailblazer and Thin Thread. The details we just don't know, because even those two systems, so much of that is still classified. The only information that we have is the stuff that these whistleblowers have given us. Now, these four whistleblowers, they were very high up in the NSA, and I tend to believe they know what they're talking about, but we still have so much that we don't know. So the only thing that I can tell you right now is we don't know what is happening currently. Here's what we do know, though. William Benny, the guy who designed Thin Thread and blew the whistle when he found out that it had been turned on Americans, this is what he said about the surveillance system that is being set up in the United States. Quote, "It's better than anything that the KGB, the Stasi, or the Gestapo and SS ever had. We're just waiting to turn the key." Unquote. Now, ordinarily, I would say something like, that's not the happiest ending to the story, but here's the thing. This story hasn't ended. This is going on right now. The Utah Data Center, they funded it. You know, we've paid for it, and that was signed into law again on March 26th, but it's not finished yet. The Utah Data Center doesn't have to exist if we decide to demand that it not exist. We can change the course of this history. We don't have to sit back and take it. But the thing is, we have to make sure that more people are aware that it's even going on, because you can't get mad about something that you don't know is happening. So we don't know what we don't know, but what we do know is the Utah Data Center. They're still collecting your information. They're still taking everything. And it's not okay. It's just not okay. There is a better way to do this. We know for a fact that there is a better way that doesn't involve collecting all of your information. And now that we have that information, we should probably do something about it. What we do something about it is something we need to figure out. Personally, I think contacting your congressman is a very good start, because at least they will know that you're on to them. So send them an email. Call them. Calls really freak them out. Do something to at least let them know that we know what's happening. And then tell your friends, tell your family. When you're at a party and something political comes up, mention it. See how many people around you know that it's happening. But that's what we need to do to actually stop this stuff. It's not too late. It's not. So that's the end of this episode. I hope you enjoyed that little story. And we're done with the continuing resolution. Congress does come back this week. Now, my prediction is we're going to have a few weeks here where not a lot gets done. So I don't know if we're going to make the full hours. We'll see. I don't really know. But there's no crises coming up until, I believe, the end of May. And the end of May is the debt ceiling, I believe. So we have a couple weeks here with nothing major going on, so we'll see what kind of bills they try to slip through while we're not really paying attention. That means I will talk to you guys next week. Have a great one.